It's How Do We Fix It with Richard and Jim.
We're not as divided as we think, Professor Mo Fiorina.
The strong partisans feel that the Democrats represent their views, the Republicans represent their views, but everybody else thinks the party system really doesn't fit, and I think it doesn't. We have a party system that was forged in the 1960s and 70s, and we've moved on. We're 50 years down the road. We have a much different electorate, and we're still trying to impose these two packages.
How do we fix it?
After the recent government shutdown, we ask, has the electorate changed? It said we're a 50-50 nation, red versus blue, split up into rival camps.
Yeah, everybody says we're so divided and much more polarized than any time in recent memory, but is it true?
Stanford University political scientist Morris Fiorina, known as Mo to his friends and colleagues, rejects this notion. Instead, he says the two parties have become polarized much more so than the voters.
Professor Fiorina is the author of the new book, Unstable Majorities, Polarization, Party Sorting, and Political Stalemate. He joins us via Skype from the Hoover Institution in Palo Alto, California.
Welcome to How Do We Fix It?
I'm glad to be here.
Professor Fiorina, first question, has the electorate fundamentally changed in recent years? Are voters, as opposed to elected politicians, more polarized than in the past?
Well, it depends on how you define polarization. That if you define polarization in the way it normally is, that the middle gives way to the extremes, then the electorate as a whole has not polarized. What I argue in the book is that rather than polarization, the electorate has sorted to some extent, that both parties, partisans in both parties, have become more homogeneous, but it still leaves out a large segment, in fact, the plurality of the population. If you look at people's self-classified ideological positions, if you look at their self-classified partisan positions, if you look at their issue positions, you find the electorate as a whole really hasn't changed since the 1970s, since the Carter and Ford years.
We are hearing so much about how social media and Facebook are driving people to the extremes. Just judged by the media, even some shows that we've done on our podcast, you would think that there's nobody left in the middle. What is your evidence for the idea that there are still a pretty sizable group that would consider themselves moderates?
The whole impact of social media is exaggerated. That research on things like the filter bubbles, ideological silos, concludes that there's really not much of it going on, mainly because not that many people actually look at social media to get their politics and their news.
So you think people are actually, they're not depending on their Facebook feeds, they're still relying on more traditional sources for news?
They're not relying on anything. the fact of the matter is, 1% of the population subscribes to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. About 1% of the population watches CNN every night, or Fox News, or MSNBC. That a relatively small portion of the population is tuned in politically. And when they go to Facebook and things like that for news, what they often mean, studies show, is they're going for sports, weather, celebrity news, and so forth. They're not really going for government politics, economics, and foreign affairs.
So we're distracted. We're not really paying attention.
For the average ordinary citizen, that's the case. Now, there is a sliver of people, the party activists, the donors. If you look at members of Congress, if you look at people who contribute to campaigns, if you look at people who work in campaigns, if you look at the leadership of the pro-choice and pro-life and pro-gun and anti-gun groups, they are highly polarized. But the point is, they're often portrayed as the norm when, in fact, they're abnormal. Almost everyone you see on TV, politically speaking, is abnormal relative to the rest of the population.
So where are some of the studies that you cited coming from?
The communication scholars are doing this. I've put in a plug here for one of my colleagues in the economics department, Matt Getzkow, who's done a lot of studies on things like fake news and social media. And also what's interesting is the companies themselves, Facebook, do these studies. They have research departments. In fact, some of our PhDs are abandoning academia and going over to much more lucrative jobs in the social media industry because they know how to analyze data. So, I mean, they're in fact, there's a very nice Facebook study a few years ago that just concludes the whole filter bubble idea is it's simply not at work. It's at work only among a very tiny sliver of the population that is really sort of basically just sort of news junkies. The problem has always been not that people get biased news, although they do, but that they don't get any news. And that's still, as far as I can tell from the communication studies, the truth, that a lot of Americans simply don't pay much attention to what's going on.
So one of your key points is that the parties have become sorted to become more ideologically extreme. I think a lot of people today, especially younger people, might be surprised to find out that it wasn't always like this. I mean, that the Democratic Party used to have conservatives and Republican Party used to have liberals.
When I tell students today that the Democratic Party used to be the racist party, for example, or that the Republican Party used to be the environmental party, they're just shocked. But the fact of the matter is, when I was not that long ago, when I was in college and graduate school, both of our parties were big tents. The Europeans used to make fun of us. They used to say that the American parties, they practiced intramural politics. They play between the 40-yard lines. The European parties play varsity politics. They use the whole field. Now the situation is reversed. The European parties have, in fact, become more centrist, in some cases disappearing entirely, the social democratic parties, whereas our parties have become much more like the European parties of the late 20th century.
I remember living in Britain in the 1970s and 80s and wishing that the British system or British politics was more like the American, that there was room for commingling between the parties politically.
Yes, and that's the way it used to be in Congress, and now it's simply not like that in Congress. The most liberal Republican is to the right of the most conservative Democrat in Congress.
So as a result, you say that in Congress, the center is empty.
Yes, it is. That's the data clearly show that.
And donors, donors who've played such a big part in politics, particularly in recent years, with very deep pockets, they tend to be ideologically committed, rigidly liberal or conservative, correct?
That is what the data show. And the other important thing is that the donors have played a role in nationalizing our elections. It used to be that an Ohio Republican and an Oregon Republican would run very different campaigns, or a New Jersey Democrat and a New Mexico Democrat. But now the Democrats get a lot of their money from California and Manhattan. Republicans get a lot of their money from Texas. And the donors can, in fact, enforce a national agenda, even in areas where the national issues might not be as important as many local issues. So they've had a definite homogenizing influence.
So if the parties are getting more ideological and more strongly divided, but the voters, for the most part, aren't, what happens to those middle-of-the-road voters? Where are they going?
Some of them don't vote at all. Some of them switch back and forth. I mean, one of the arguments I make in the book is about how the fact that neither party can construct a lasting majority, that Congress is up for grabs every election, the presidential races are very close, that minority people who lose the popular vote win. And I argue that it stems from the fact that once a party wins, then they try to implement a policy that reflects the preferences of their base. So in the next election, all the people, the marginal people who gave you your majority in the last election, defect. They say, I didn't vote for Social Security personal accounts, or I didn't vote for Obamacare. And they defect, and you get hammered in the next election, which is why you lose your majority. So I think the fact that this, what I call a ping-ponging pattern of politics, to these unstable majorities, reflects the fact that each party is a minority party. The strong partisans feel that the Democrats represent their views, the Republicans represent their views, but everybody else thinks the party system really doesn't fit, and I think it doesn't. We have a party system that was forged in the 1960s and 70s, and we've moved on. We're 50 years down the road. We have a much different electorate, and we're still trying to impose these two packages that have come on a very heterogeneous electorate, and the electorate as a whole is just not in tune with it.
Do you think that one reason why Donald Trump was elected in 2016 was because he didn't fit neatly into the package, that he was seen as not a typical Republican?
Yes, part of Trump's appeal was he was a de-sorter, that he didn't have this. And you remember, a lot of the Republican intellectual class, Bill Kristol and others, were sort of, George Will, horrified about his package of positions. But it just went to show that even base Republican voters weren't nearly as ideologically conservative as the thought leaders thought they were.
Do you think that Trump has missed an opportunity, though, by governing largely as a rigid ideologue and appealing to his base, rather than seizing the opportunity to reach across the aisle?
Yes. that I thought there was a potential for Trump to split both parties. And I think the party system badly needs to be shaken up. And the perfect vehicle for this would have been a huge infrastructure program, which would have put the blue collar wing of the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, against more or less the environmental wing and so forth, and would have put the business wing of the Republican Party against the sort of deficit hawks and so forth. He had the potential to really drive a wedge into both parties, but he didn't take advantage of that.
You know, speaking of the blue collar voters, the divide between the two extremes, conservative and liberal, may not be as strong among voters as a lot of us had thought, but there is a pretty big divide between elite and non-elite voters. And didn't that also play a part in the Trump victory?
Yes, it did. And clearly there's something worldwide going on, or at least in the Western world, that you look at Brexit, you look at Le Pen, you look at Merkel's problems forming a government, you look at the Italian system coming apart. This problem, though, there are people who are being left behind as social and economic transformations occur in the world, and there are people who are gaining, who are profiting from those. And the latter group simply has not paid much attention to those being left behind. And I think that sense that and it's pretty the case in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has gone upscale over the years, but the old-time Democratic Party, the party of Franklin Roosevelt, has not done so well under these social and economic transformations.
Looking ahead to the elections later this year, the 2018 midterms, it's quite possible the Democrats could do very much better than they did in 2016, could possibly take control of the House and the Senate. But if that happened, would that change be likely to last?
I don't see the way out of our current instability at the moment. David Brooks some years ago said, what we need is a younger, saner Ross Perot. And I think it's going to take something like that. It's going to take a self-funded candidate. You think about that Macron in France, for example. We need a Macron. It's much harder in our system.
This is Emmanuel Macron, the relatively recently elected president who came in as a centrist.
Yes.
So when the two parties are very close in numbers, and so you have this unstable, these unstable majorities. When they do get into positions of power, it seems like you say they spend most of their time trying to, or if they're, whether they're in power or not. Let me start that question again because I'm kind of bumbling it.
Jim never bumbles. This is a rarity.
Yes, it's not uncommon that our guests are far more focused and well spoken than the hosts are.
Spit it out, Jim.
On this show. So, one of the points you make is that when you have these unstable majorities, both parties are really invested in beating up on the other party and taking positions that embarrass the other party. Yet you say, and I quote, they're perfectly prepared to shift positions on a dime if it embarrasses the other party. Aren't we seeing some of that right now?
Oh, yeah. We've been seeing that a lot in recent years. I mean, in Obamacare, for example, the whole Massachusetts, look at the Massachusetts healthcare system that Romney was so proud of when he was governor of Massachusetts, that came right out of the Heritage Foundation. Now, a few years later, when Romney's running for office, he's got to reject his past achievements. And now it's become a sort of a big government oppressive position because the Democrats proposed it. The parties simply want to pick an issue that defeats, that embarrasses and defeats the other party to help them gain a majority. And if it involves ideological inconsistency, that's not a problem. They're perfectly prepared to do it.
Right. Richard and I, before the show, we were joking that the Democrats used to be the anti-immigration party.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because of labor.
It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And our guest is Professor Mo Farina of Stanford University. Sorry? What?
Fiorina.
Fiorina.
Oh, what did I say?
Yeah. I'm always having to correct Richard's pronunciation of our guest.
Our guest is Professor.
Yeah, pronounce all the vowels. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm going to try right now. Our guest is Professor Mo Fiorina of Stanford University. Before we continue, Jim, an appeal for help from our listeners. This will take you about 5 seconds to simply rate us and review us on iTunes. Makes a big difference to us. And tell your friends about us, too.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So let's talk about how we might possibly change this. Is there any hope for independence or third party?
Yes, as I was indicating a few minutes ago, I think that's probably the only avenue by which we change this. Barring some, the other possibility is in the book, I talk about the similarity of the current period to the period of the late 19th century, which is also a very chaotic political period and also was a period during the Industrial Revolution, massive movements from people from farms to cities, mass immigration. Many of the same kinds of social and economic transformations were going on then. Now, what happened is basically an economic depression in the 1890s. The McKinley Republicans win, and they govern in a way that the population approves of. And we have 14 consecutive years of unified Republican government. Now, that's one possibility, that some sort of catastrophe occurs under either Trump or under some Democratic administration, and the population turns to the other party, and the other party delivers. The problem we've had in the last 20 years is neither party has delivered. The other possibility is, as we talked about, a top-down where a third party candidate, a younger senator, Ross Perot, manages to fracture the system.
Your idea of an unstable majority runs very much against what a lot of partisans would like to believe. Back in 2004, Karl Rove thought that the Republicans were going to be in charge for a generation.
And he was called a political mastermind by his opponents.
Right. Yeah. And James Carville thought that, you know, the Democrats were going to be in charge for 40 years. Why do people keep underestimating this lack of stability for whichever party happens to be on top?
I think that really strong partisans have an amazing ability to delude themselves, to simply look at facts that seem consistent with their views and ignore everything that doesn't. And they somehow seem to think that the party, that the electorate as a whole turned around and gave their president a mandate. No, the American people don't give mandates. The American people hire you on probation.
You're in California, Mo, and in California, they changed the way that congressional districts were sorted and have an independent vote commission. Has that made any kind of difference to the kind of candidates who are selected?
Well, there's a very little research on it so far, and we're going to need a lot more before we can talk about the effects of the institutional change. But one of the hopes that people who supported this was that in areas where only a Democrat could be elected, that or a Republican, that the top two candidates, even from the same party, one would have an incentive to move toward the middle. So you might have a very liberal Democrat running against a more moderate Democrat. And there is, I think, a little bit of anecdotal evidence that some of that is occurring.
One of the big concerns of a lot of people over the years has been the way that incumbents get so entrenched in their position, certainly in the House and the Senate. Are they just as locked in place as ever, or is that also becoming less stable?
Much less stable, not anymore. This is one of those cases where conventional wisdom has not caught up with the research yet, that the incumbency advantage has been pretty much steadily declining for 20 years. So, and I think it reflects the fact that basically these are not independent operators anymore, that you elect a Democrat to Congress and that Democrat is going to vote just like the Democratic Party, everybody else in the Democratic Party. They're not tailoring their positions anymore for their districts. And so people are now voting much more for the party.
And that's equally true with Republicans too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Your finding about incumbents gives me a little bit of hope, and we are a show about solutions, that it will be easier to challenge incumbents in the future if what you're saying is correct.
That's right. There's a couple things that have led into that. In addition to the people knowing they're voting for control of the institution, not just their personal representative, also the nationalization of fundraising means that if they sense the leadership, the brain trust in Republicans and Democratic parties, sense weakness anywhere, they can direct funds to challengers in those areas. The challengers are no longer on their own. And so there are very few incumbents, or fewer incumbents today get a free ride compared to 30 years ago.
So we're a show about solutions. Are there any tweaks you would make to the system? If you could rewire our political computer, what would you change?
I think primaries are a problem, that it's only the most rabid supporters of a party or a candidate who get out to vote. I think it would be, I'd like to see it easier to get third candidates into the debate. So basically, we have a two-party duopoly, which is not very representative of the country as a whole. It's as if we had both Chevrolet and only Chevrolet and Ford, neither one made very good cars, and you wouldn't let any other car company into the system. So anything that would sort of allow for a greater competition to break the two-party duopoly, I think, would probably be something I'd like to look at.
And also allowing and encouraging independents to vote in party primaries would also help, too. You have some states where you can only vote in a Democratic primary or a Republican primary if you're registered as a Republican or a Democrat.
That's correct, but the problem is most of them still just aren't motivated enough to go out to vote. That the research on this suggests it's not a big effect, open versus closed.
Well, you've raised a really interesting point, which is in many other countries, the turnout for elections is much, much higher than it is in the United States.
That's the case, although it's interesting that in most other democracies, turnout has been declining fairly sharply. It's not as big a difference as it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Remember, we're asked to vote a lot. We're asked to vote in primaries, propositions, referenda. I get to vote for the commissioners of the Port of Redwood City, for God's sakes. Whereas in a lot of these other countries, you maybe have one election or two elections every 5 years. In Britain, you vote for parliament maybe every 5 years, and you maybe have a European parliamentary election. And they don't have primaries and so forth. So an election is sort of a bigger deal in those countries.
Yeah, in the Connecticut town where I spend a good deal of time, there's a completely separate date for town elections and then for referenda or bond issues than there are for everything else. So you find yourself going to the polls a tremendous number of times if you're among the 10% who actually vote in every single election.
You're saying you vote early and often?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. One of my colleagues out here a few years ago just carefully kept track. He would have been, if he had tried to vote in every election he was eligible, he would have had to vote 17 times in a 2-year period.
Wow. Another solution that comes to mind is that if all of us would generalize a little bit less about politics, it would be helpful. For instance, one fact about Trump voters, you always think of them as aggrieved, poor, low-income, working-class white voters. The actual average Trump voter made more money in 2016 than the average Democratic voter did.
That's right.
It's easy to generalize.
Yeah, that's right. The data suggested that it wasn't that they were themselves poor, but they were pessimistic about the economic prospects of their areas, pessimistic about the economic prospects of their kids. And so I think it was not that they personally had lost their job. It was more of generalized pessimism.
Professor Mo Fiorina of Stanford University, thanks very much for joining us. Your findings about the number of people who are independents as opposed to strict party ideologues is fascinating.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
So, Richard, I always feel like the first step to finding solutions is making sure you've analyzed the problem correctly. There's so many people, so many pundits who argue things they think are self-evidently true. And it's great to have somebody on like Mo Fiorina who says, well, first, you know, we need data.
And one of the most stunning pieces of data, a matter of public record, is that the largest group of self-identified voters in the United States are independents,
right?
About 40%, and that number has steadily gone up during recent years, whereas you'd think if we are really a 50-50, totally divided nation yelling at each other from left and right, that the number of people who say they're independent would go down.
You know, there's this kind of broad, kind of not very extreme middle on very many issues that both parties are tending to ignore.
And that's the one hope I had when Trump was elected, that maybe he would govern more as a business person, as a pragmatist, and would try and move to the middle and appeal to Democrats. It simply hasn't
done it.
He has spoken entirely to his base.
Well, you know, when you talk about Trump's base, it's not even clear what that is, because the people who passionately voted for him, they have a sort of a smorgasbord of political ideas, some of which are conservative. Many aren't. I would bet there are, you know, for example, being anti-trade used to be a liberal position, being anti-free trade, being anti-NAFTA and stuff. And a lot of Republicans are pretty happy with some of the deregulation, stuff like that. But I totally agree with you. He's not laying the groundwork for continued success of the Republican Party or even for his own reelection.
Okay, well, I want to switch to some solutions and throw out some ideas at you. I think it would be good if we made voting easier. For instance, changing the election day from Tuesday to Sunday, like they have done in many other countries. It seems crazy to have elections being held on work days. And also something that Mo mentioned is that in many towns and cities around the country, you can find yourself voting at least 10 times a year on various issues.
And some of those elections, some of those local elections, you know, the turnout is so tiny. And that's how sometimes, even on the local level, extremists or people who are, you know, kind of out on the edge on some single issue often do get elected, even though they're probably not that, these positions aren't that popular with most voters.
I'm not sure you're going to agree with me on this one. I think there ought to be blue sky donor laws. I think we ought to know where political groups' money is coming from.
Yeah.
There ought to be more open disclosure of that.
I think we could do a show on that. There's some downsides to that.
What, in not telling people where donors' money is coming from?
Do you want your political donations singled out and maybe flyers sent to everyone in your building what if you were a Republican? Do you want a flyer to everyone on your block sent? Richard Davies gave money to...
I think you can delineate between what individuals do. You would have a limit on overall individual donations, but if it's a group donation, the group donation
is
pretty clear.
I mean, as a whole, I'm in favor of transparency, but I'm also in favor of people having the freedom to exercise their political views without becoming targets.
Yeah, and then the other thing, and this is hearkening back to our show with Eric Liu, one of my favorite Fix-It shows, Eric Liu of Citizens University, who talked about the need for us to learn about power, how it's exercised. And he says, if there's one thing we could do individually to improve the political situation in this country, it's join a club.
But there's one thing I would add. I mentioned earlier, there's this split between the elite and the more mainstream or non-elite society. Well, the elite is almost universally to the left in terms of the people, you know, running the universities, controlling the media, and I'm not talking about news.
I'm sorry. I'm really going to push back at you on this. I mean, the idea that the elite is almost universally of the left is in my view, not true at all. For instance, when you look at the donor class, you look at the Koch brothers.
No, there's rich Republicans.
For instance, and they are very active in changing the political
Do they have a top 10 show on TV? Do they have any writers writing for SNL?
But they're spending more money contributing to political campaigns.
Right, sure. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm not saying that the elite is either all one thing or the other, but you kind of are, and I disagree with
you. Well, but the cultural conversation is dominated by a left-leaning worldview. In one of his pieces, Mo made this point. He said that the mainstream saw this relentless kind of anti-Republican, anti-working class attitude coming from movies and TV shows and comedy. And they said, wow, these people really don't like us. And then Trump comes along and he sounds like one of them. He talks like one of them despite being rich. And seems to take their side. And that was very appealing to people who feel they've been disrespected, not just overlooked, but actively disrespected.
Yeah, but the reason why Trump got elected is not just because of his base. It's because he had the letter R after his name. And a lot of people who always vote Republican were reluctant not to vote for Donald Trump. So I do think that this whole idea that Trump's base is somehow a vast number of people is a little bit over-exaggerated.
I agree. I think his base is not anywhere near as big as people say. I think both sides have to lower the temperature a little bit. But I think when there's this message out there that one side disdains the other side, you know, that all Trump voters are racist, for example, or all Democratic voters are socialists, that is pushing this polarization, or it's taking people in the middle and it's kicking them out of the system
and turning them off. It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
I'm Jim Meggs,
and thanks for joining us. Our producer is Miranda Schaefer. The music is by Lou Stravinsky, and we are a production of Davies Content. We make digital audio for companies and nonprofits. Check us out at our website, daviescontent.com.